It's Central Time. I'm Jake Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, the author of a new book looks at the long-term impact of many young people choosing to leave their small-town roots behind in search of other cultural and economic opportunities. First, thanks to a new NCAA rule change, student athletes in college are now allowed to profit from their name, image, or likeness.
What's going on, everybody? Graham Mertz here. I'm excited to announce I'm officially dropping my merchandise website, grahammertzshop.com. I'm going to put it in the caption under here, but we'd love for you guys to go check it out, buy some sweet gear, and I appreciate the support. There's more to come.
That was Graham Mertz, as you just heard, a sophomore quarterback for the Wisconsin Badgers football team, in a video posted on Twitter on July 1st. And that was also the day the rules change went into effect. We're going to be talking more about the changes and UW's temporary policy for managing it. Rich Kramer is WPR's higher education reporter, and I spoke with him on Friday about the change. Here's our conversation. So as of right now, this is a temporary policy. So what are the students allowed to do and what aren't they allowed to do with this current policy?
Well, it's all very complicated for me. I'm a higher education reporter, but I don't follow sports law very often, if at all, I should be honest. But what students are allowed to do right now is the temporary rules from the NCAA, and there are temporary rules at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They can profit off of their name, image, and likeness. So, you know, think of bobbleheads, t-shirts, autograph signings. These are the things that we're starting to see college athletes wade into. So that was not allowed under the previous NCAA rules.
But what they can't do right now, it seems, is use the University of Wisconsin's logos. Am I correct there?
From the temporary rules that I read at with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, students are able to use the university's logos, but there's a whole process for getting prior approval, and it seems pretty complicated. So I'm not entirely sure. The Badgers quarterback, Graham Mertz, has already taken advantage of this and issued a clothing line, and it does have pictures of him, like caricatures of him in his uniform, but there's not any obvious Badgers logos or Wisconsin logos. So it seems like he's playing it safe, and that could speak to the nature of that rule.
Let's stick with Graham Mertz for a second. That's a Badger quarterback, and I'm actually looking at his shirts right now, and it looks like they're using, or that Graham and his affiliates are using, you know, the UW-Madison, the red and white colors. He's doing these action shots where he's, like, clearly playing for the football team. Have any other players jumped on this bandwagon?
Not that I've seen. Graham Mertz has really gone all in with the clothing line. He even teased it. He had a video that he put on Twitter prior to the NCAA rule change going into effect, which was July 1st. So 2 days prior, he basically put a teaser video out that hinted at his upcoming logo. So he's got a special logo. It's got a GM, you know, branded thing. And also, you know, and then on July 1st, he said he's got this merchandise site. And like you mentioned, it's all kinds of options. There's, you know, the t-shirts, the hoodies, there's baby clothes. So as far as Badgers players, he's the only one to go that far. But Graham Mertz also tweeted that Mission Barbecue, which has restaurants around Wisconsin, is the official sponsor or barbecue sponsor for the Badgers offensive line. So I don't know what the nature of that agreement is. I don't know if that means they get free food or if they're getting, you know, paid a little bit. I have no idea.
Yeah, let's stick with that for a second, Rich, because Mission Barbecue has said that they're proud to sponsor the offensive line. But you talked to some other business owners who could profit off of this as well. What did you hear from other businesses?
Yeah, I basically was digging through the replies to Graham Mertz's his initial tweets about his merchandise line, And I saw there was a fella named Tom Kolcheski who owns Real Sports Cards. It's a sports card sales website, but also there's a couple stores, a new one being built in Waupun. So I saw Tom Kolcheski basically reply to Graham Mertz's initial tweet saying, hey, we'd love to have you for an autograph signing. So that raised my interest. I gave Tom a call, and he said he would love to have Graham Mertz at his shop, the one that's being built right now in Waupun, and do an autograph signing. So what Tom told me is that he doesn't know, you know, he's very well versed in the sports memorabilia realm, but he doesn't know what it's worth. He doesn't know how much these players would get for a signature or how much, you know, they should be paid for such a thing. But he basically has an open invitation to the Badgers quarterback because he'd love to have him over. So Tom Kolcheski pointed out that the quarterback of the Oklahoma Sooners, Spencer Rattler, is doing an autograph signing where he's going to get $150 per signature. That's the way what's been reported. Kolcheski said that's crazy because that's the same amount of money that NFL players get. And he told me that in terms of sports memorabilia, like signed, you know, cards, for example, their worth really goes up once that player transitions to the National Football League and not as valuable in the college uniform. So he said it's basically kind of a new frontier that everyone's going to have to figure out.
So this is a new frontier, and you teased just a few minutes ago that this issue is extremely complicated at the university. What have we heard so far from higher education leadership at UW-Madison?
Well, the only real statement that I've gotten or been able to find comes from Chancellor Rebecca Blank at UW-Madison. She sent a letter to Congress. This was prior to the NCAA's change on name, image, license going into effect. And she was urging the Congress to set federal standards, you know, have a level playing field across the country. She said, you know, these are academic athletes. It's all about amateurism, you know, the collegiate experience. She basically said that she doesn't think they should be paid because they're not professional athletes, that it's all about the education and helping get them well-rounded and have something like a degree once they leave school. But in terms of the federal standards, she said they're necessary because it doesn't take a lot of imagination, she said, to imagine a car dealership somewhere offering a big pile of money to a promising, you know, high school star quarterback to go to one university versus the other. So she said that, you know, right now, states around the country, Florida, for example, have passed their own rules on this, like legislation. Wisconsin hasn't done that yet. So UW-Madison has a temporary policy, but that's it. So she's hoping for federal action. I talked with our Capitol reporter, Laurel White, and she hasn't heard anything about state legislation. So at this point, it's still kind of a gray area.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR higher education reporter. I spoke with him last Friday about his reporting on University of Wisconsin student athletes beginning to take advantage of a rules change, allowing them to profit from their name, image, and likeness. That is a very recent rules change from the NCAA. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about why the NCAA made this decision? What concerns or thoughts do you have as it relates to the college experience for these athletes or for college sports in general? How do you think businesses and brands should approach this situation? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we will continue this conversation with a sports and media journalist who's been covering this issue for years. That's coming up next right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the NCAA rules change that now allows student athletes at colleges and universities to sign endorsement deals and make money beyond just the scholarships they receive from their own likeness. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Should student athletes be allowed to make money when they're on a team? Do you think, the NCAA made the right decision here? Maybe if you were a student athlete in the past and you weren't able to profit off your own name and likeness, we want to hear from you too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Ben Strauss joins us now. He covers sports and media for the Washington Post and is the co-author of the book Indentured, the inside story of the rebellion against the NCAA. Ben, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
So we've been talking so far about the Wisconsin athletes who have started to take advantage of this rule change, but they're not the only ones in the country, right? What have we heard from other schools and athletes that have decided to take advantage of this rules change?
Well, we've heard from many of them, and just to name a few outside of Wisconsin, the Michigan football team has done a group agreement with one of the local apparel stores in Ann Arbor to get cuts of jersey sales, which is a pretty interesting development. We've seen the quarterback at Alabama sign endorsement deals in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. We've seen women's basketball players at Fresno State enter an agreement, and everything from fast food restaurants to t-shirt companies all sorts of types of things, apparel, for their jerseys and getting a cut of that, as I mentioned. So it's been pretty widespread, the types of the deals, and also, around the country and different types of athletes playing different types of sports too, men and women.
And it seems that the quickness with which these athletes, decided to take advantage of the rules change made it seem a little bit like they've been waiting for this for a long time. Can you give us a little bit of the history of this rules change just over the last few decades even?
Yeah, so the reason we're talking about this is not, a sports story, but, higher education story and a fairly big deal is that the bedrock of college sports for, decades has been this concept of amateurism, which was, put into place in the 1950s and has, stood for years up until really just a few weeks ago. And the idea is that people, athletes, competed in college sports and were not allowed to earn money outside of a scholarship. And, the NCAA has spent really millions of dollars at this point defending amateurism against lawsuits and a union push by the Northwestern football team a few years ago. And only very recently, the last couple of weeks, really did a total about face and said, we're not going to stand in the way of these states that have passed these laws. And we're going to sort of step aside and really not do the one thing that we've been doing, since the 1950s, and that's enforce these amateurism rules. So huge, huge change that has been challenged in courts and by players and most recently by a number of state legislatures that passed laws. But this was a long time coming.
Yeah. And I'm curious too, Ben, if we could take kind of like a real zoomed out look. It seems like it's not just a sea change at the university level or among students, but there's been kind of a wider acceptance that kind of the system, the NCAA rules, haven't really been fair. How much has that played a role in maybe the NCAA reevaluating this rule?
Yeah, I think, certainly you look at why state legislatures around the country got interested in this issue and why there have been lawsuits about it. If you just look around, in the last 20 years or so, people started getting very, very rich in college sports, and coaches can make $5, $6, $7, $8, $9 million. The athletic directors can make a couple million dollars. Conference commissioners can be millionaires. The TV contracts are in the billions of dollars. And so when you contrast sort of all of this money that's in college sports with players who, you know, are banned or were banned from participating in any, you know, part of this economy, aside from they get their scholarships and, you know, a few extra benefits, it's really stark. And so as the money got really, really big, you know, in the last 20 years, but really in the last like 10 years, it's been harder and harder to justify this system where, you know, on one side of the equation, you're going to squeeze every single dollar you can out of this enterprise. You know, schools will change conferences because there's more money on the other side, and, you know, coaches will jump around, but players are really prohibited from, you know, joining this economy. It was getting harder and harder to defend how you could have, you know, two sides of that coin.
We are talking to Ben Strauss right now. He covers sports and media for The Washington Post. He's also the co-author of the book called Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. And we just had a caller who could not stay on the line, who said that if college football players already get their tuition paid for, they should not also get paid, that it's not fair to other athletes in sports who would not get treated the same. Are we seeing kind of sort of a built-in inequity with the players and the teams that might get these deals and those that don't?
Well, if you look at the system the way it is today, it's the football team is bringing in all of the money. So, I mean, the inequities are sort of built in by the way the school distributes its resources. It doesn't pay the football coach the same as it pays the gymnastics coach. And the football players and the men's basketball players are, you know, decidedly on campus to do one thing, and that is make money for the school, which is a responsibility no other athletes on campus have. So somehow that there are these NIL deals that some players have access to and others don't is going to be some sort of sea change in equity. I find that, you know, fairly hard to believe.
Now, you have been following this for a really long time. Did you ever expect to see this rule change happen, certainly in the way that it kind of got rolled out?
You know, it's actually a really interesting question. There was a time a few years ago, I think it was 2016, when the Northwestern football team, tried to form a union. And initially, it was recognized by the Labor Relations Board in Chicago. And at the same time, there was a big lawsuit about name, image, and likeness, and a former UCLA basketball player sued the NCAA for not, you know, for making money on a video game, but not allowing, you know, the former player to be paid for using his image in the video game. And so those two legal battles really came to a head at the same time, and both initially were victories for the players that on appeal were sort of neutered and, while not totally overturned, basically had the effect of maintaining the status quo. And in that moment, I thought for sure the system was going to have to change. But then, as I mentioned, the status quo sort of won out, and I wasn't totally sure. So, you know, in some ways, I was very surprised at how quickly it seemed to flip on its head at the NCAA and among some of the schools. But in otherwise, it's really been a long time coming. So I think it's probably a combination of, you know, being very surprised and also not being very surprised at all.
Yeah. I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Josh in Oak Creek. Hi, Josh.
Hey, guys. I have a question. I'm all for the athletes, you know, getting this. As he just put it, it flip-flopped pretty quick. I'm wondering if there's any evidence or history of this decision being that because it's such a grand change, did the NCAA decide, okay, we'll do this, but do these athletes actually have to give a small percentage of their new earnings to the NCAA? Because it seems to me that the flip-flop was so fast, as you just stated, that you think they wouldn't do it without getting something out of it.
Josh, thank you so much for that call. Ben, do you think that there might be some mutually beneficial work happening in the background that led to this change?
Yeah, it's a fair question given the 180 that seemed to happen, but I don't think so. I think that a couple things happened that made it happen so fast. One was you had all of these, you know, states around the country, you had dozens of states that had passed laws that these new rules were going to go into effect. So they didn't really come out of nowhere. And a lot of them, or some of them, were going to go into effect on July 1st. So the NCAA had this deadline of how it was going to handle these state laws and what it was going to do about name, image, and likeness. So it was sort of this big deadline that was hanging over, you know, the college sports establishment. And then a week before that, the Supreme Court decided a different case, which was not about name, image, and likeness, but was about educational benefits. But the court found unanimously against the NCAA and essentially said that, you know, if there was another court case where, you know, amateurism was going to be on trial, the NCAA couldn't say, you know, amateurism is the secret sauce that we have, and the only reason we have college sports is because of amateurism. It really put a body blow to the NCAA's legal defense. And there was a separate opinion written by Judge Kavanaugh that basically said, if I saw a case that was like, can players get paid, you know, the big case, you know, I don't think that I would be confident in the NCAA's defense. And so this was a really sort of monumental shift in the way the Supreme Court talked about the issue. And it was very just a couple days after that the NCAA announced that they were not going to challenge any of these state laws. So I think that played a fairly significant role too.
Now, Ben, we only have about 30 seconds left, but what will you be watching for, you know, as the football season gets started with this issue?
One thing that I'm very curious about is we've seen people start to sign deals and you know, it's interesting and exciting. I wonder how recruiting is going to get affected. I think that's the one area, you know, what kind of things are, you know, schools going to be able to offer directly to players and boosters and things, and will it actually change any of the, you know, recruiting dynamics? Is there a smaller school that might not be able to compete with Alabama if they're only offering scholarships, but, you know, there's a booster at Marshall or something that, you know, says we really want this player? Like, could, you know, smaller schools compete, you know, for bigger
for talent? Yeah. Ben, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's Ben Strauss. He covers sports and media for The Washington Post. We talked with him about the recent NCAA rules change that allows student athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness. Coming up after the news, when you move away from your hometown, do you still feel connected to it? We'll talk more about that in just a minute. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and I'm in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us today. Have you ever had a hard time finding a contractor, or you weren't sure what questions to ask them? On the morning show, they kick off their Ask a Contractor series. That's tomorrow after 8. Now, many young people who grow up in rural communities choose to leave as young adults, maybe for college or different opportunities, and few make plans to return home anytime soon. For some, that means leaving behind a strong sense of place and community. Knowing your neighbors and being close to friends and family are just a couple of the perks of living in a smaller town. But is that enough to sustain rural areas as many see their population declining? In her new book, our next guest explores what it means to leave behind our roots and how modern ideas of what it means to be successful, economic opportunity, self-improvement, or growth often leave small communities out of the conversation. And if you're from a rural area, we would love to hear your thoughts. Did you move away from your hometown? Are you still there? What influenced your decision? Was it work, family, or something else? Did you miss your hometown, and did you end up going back? Call give us an email at ideas@wpr.org, and we would love to get those messages and hear your story. Grace Olmsted is a journalist who focuses on farming, localism, and family. Her writing has appeared in publications like the American Conservative and the New York Times. Her book is called Uprooted: Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. Central Time host Rob Ferret talked to Grace earlier this year. Here's their conversation.
You tell the story of a lot of communities and people, and one of those people is you. Can you share a little bit of your story and how you left and then revisited your community?
Absolutely. I grew up in small town Idaho, in a town of about 3,000 people, and was a part of a family that had lived in Idaho since the turn of the century. I'm pretty sure my great-great-great-grandfather homesteaded there in about 1904. But I left to go to college on the East Coast in Virginia and ended up getting a job and marrying someone in the Air Force and just stayed out on the East Coast. But the longer I was away from home, the more homesick I became and the more I began to consider how my roots in Idaho made me who I am. And so as I started to work on some projects revolving around agriculture, I decided to take all my research and my homesickness back to Idaho with me and to talk to people in my home community and to find out how people were doing there and what was going on in that small community after I had left it behind.
Grace, I feel like I could go through your book, cross out the word Idaho and write Wisconsin in, and it would still make a lot of sense to people here. Can you talk a little bit about farming in your hometown, how it's changed over the years? It's going to sound familiar, I think, to a lot of people here.
Yeah, definitely. Well, agriculture in Idaho has continued to grow more concentrated as family farms have either grown in size or disappeared with time. You see a lot of farmers struggling to make ends meet as they deal with changes in markets and in agribusinesses that put extra pressures on them. They have increasing input costs along with a narrowing profit margins that have really made it difficult to keep the farm alive. And in addition to that, you have a lot of young people growing up in these communities who have no interest in either inheriting a family farm or perhaps doing the work of starting a farm themselves. And so a lot of farm towns are seeing an aging generation of farmers and a decreasing prospect of future farmers raised in the land where they were originally from. And so in the town that I profile, the number of children younger than 18 living in Emmett continues to decline. The median age is always going up. And a lot of the high schoolers that I talk to in my book say that they don't have any intention of staying in the town or in the surrounding area once they graduate high school.
And a real core to that is, if you, high school kid, want to be successful in life as defined in a number of different ways, you can do it. But you can't really do it here. Can you talk about that lack of a path, a vision for people to grow into a life they want in the town they grew up in?
Absolutely. I think part of that has to do with a growing lack of economic opportunity in rural towns as mom and pop businesses and other regional sources of economic strength go away. But there's also a lot of cultural messages we receive as young people that tell us if we're successful or smart, we need to leave. You know, there's always that saying you hear, you'll go far, which is a compliment, whereas the idea of settling is usually a bad thing. And so we have a lot of messages surrounding exodus if you're growing up in rural America. But I contrast that in my book to the life of my great-grandfather, who was born in the town where he eventually died. He lived all 96 years of his life in the same region, indeed, probably within the same about 10 to 20 mile radius. And so that was a remarkable legacy. And what's interesting to me is that it was never seen as a bad thing. In fact, it was a sign of his success. And he was kind of a local hero for a lot of people, someone everyone looked up to. And so for him, staying in place for his entire life was a good thing, and it was something people praised him for. And so I kind of tried to look at how things have changed and why it is that now, if someone were to live all 96 years of their life in one spot, we wouldn't necessarily see them as a success story.
We're talking to Grace Olmsted about her new book, Uprooted: Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. Grace, let's tackle now this central concept in your book, the idea of being rooted. What do you mean by that in this day? It might not look like that 96-year stay in the same city, but what does it mean to capture that idea of being rooted in the community we live in?
Well, I think very essential to that idea is that even if you're not living in the community where you grew up, you are a very a given member of that society. You love your place, you care for it in the way that you live, in the way that you're involved in the life of the community, and you understand some of the things that make it special and that make it particularly needful of your presence. One thing I really wanted to emphasize as I worked on this book is that many places need us and they need our membership. And yet in America today, we've kind of emphasized this idea of rootlessness, that we are best served by constant mobility and transience. But Simone Weil, who is a famous French philosopher, once wrote that actually in the great need to be rooted, that to be rooted is perhaps the most important and least recognized need of the human soul. And so the idea of rootedness is meant to just combat the idea that every place is interchangeable with other places and that we can easily abandon places that might need us in a deeper sense. And loving place, I think, involves being a faithful, rooted member of our societies and communities and looking for ways that we can give to them, even as they, in many ways, can give back to us.
I wanted to get into a couple things that you're not saying in the book. And one of those things is you're not saying, I think, is this is inevitable, that this decline has to happen. You highlight the stories of some people who have gone into farming in new places, in the places they grew up, whatever the case might be, who are doing things in a new way that might paint a pathway forward. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was very honored to get to talk to a lot of people who are perhaps returners, as they're called, people who left Emmett, Idaho for other places throughout the U.S. for college and then eventually found their way back home, as well as newcomers from places like California who are bringing their talents and skill sets with them and planting them in the soil of this farm community. So I profile a farm that is raising fruits and vegetables on the outskirts of Emmett and works at the major farmers markets in and around the town. And that's very committed to growing opportunities to have local food sovereignty and health in place through their work, as well as a farm that's doing a regenerative beef operation, pasture raised beef that then goes to a lot of farmers markets as well as a large local population in Emmett. And both of these farms are just a couple of examples of people who are very excited about growing opportunity in Emmett, feeding a local population, and making sure that farms don't go away.
Let's bring on a caller. Addie is with us in Eau Claire. Addie, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Addie?
So I'm a senior this year, and I go to a small rural town school. And so the attitude behind the jobs that your guest is describing is like really negative and almost kind of like those jobs are for people that are less intelligent. And I've noticed like as senior this year with like pushing us towards careers, those careers haven't been mentioned at all. And that hasn't been, that's more seen as a, if you aren't smart enough or you can't afford college, then you decide on this, but that's almost disappointing.
Addie, thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me, you wrote about, I can't remember who said it in your book, Grace, but something like, yeah, my counselor almost, you know, passed out when I said I wanted to stay in town or work at a farm or something like that. People like Addie and others steered away from those jobs that they could actually get in that community.
And it's crazy to me because if you look at the actual work of being a farmer, it requires such intelligence and diligence and study. And every time I've been out in the fields talking to a farmer, I realize how little I know about what they do and that it would take a lifetime to be able to accomplish all that they have. I think we need to emphasize with greater and greater ability as we're able just how important it is to have our best and brightest students out working the land. It's where our food comes from. It's going to be absolutely vital for ongoing environmental conservation. And it's such a wonderful opportunity for young people to see how they can bring their talents to bear in their home communities and grow a lot of health as a result.
That's Grace Olmsted, a journalist who focuses on farming, localism, and family. We're listening back to her conversation earlier this year with Central Time host Rob Ferret. Her book is called Uprooted, Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. Coming up, we'll hear more from Grace about nostalgia, our hometown's effect on how we ultimately settle, and even how plants and food can provide a connection to where we grew up, no matter where we live now. We'll hear the rest of that conversation coming up right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're listening back to a conversation from earlier this year with journalist Grace Olmsted about her book Uprooted, Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. In it, she looks at the sense of community in rural areas, how it shapes people no matter where they ultimately end up, and how some people are working to keep smaller towns vibrant and growing. And we heard from Adrian, who wrote to us to say, I grew up in the 1960s on what today would be called a hobby farm. My rural upbringing informed my decision on where to raise my kids, on a farm. Now I'm looking to retire in a rural area, but the problem I've always faced is finding work in an area that supports a family. And you can share your stories at ideas@wpr.org. And thank you, Adrian, for that email. Now we hear the rest of Rob and Grace's conversation. During their talk, they got a call from a Central Time listener, Connie in Wausau. Here's what she had to say.
Well, I am 75, and I didn't go to college until I was older in life. And I lived in St. Louis, got my undergrad and master's there. And at age 50, moved to Cincinnati to get my PhD in urban history. So I find this topic truly amazing. I write, still my history that I write about is St. Louis, and I go back there for research. I actually thought when I retired I would move back there. It's still home to me. That's what I call home. I cross over the bridge and see that arch, and I know I'm home even after 25 years. But I'm staying in Wisconsin, in Wausau, Wisconsin, because I have a son who is divorced. And we are moving to Marshfield and buying a house together so I can help him with his kids. But I get this feeling, and I love the book. I wish I were still teaching, because the books that I would use in class are about city living and small town living. And teaching in Wisconsin with the rural life up here, I think it would have been a perfect crossover to bring that in as well. And I love the idea. To me, home is where your heart is.
Connie, thank you so much. St. Louis's loss is our gain here in Wisconsin. Grace, I don't know, she kind of did this in reverse a little bit, but still that she's not in the place that her heart is, and she has that yearning for it.
And I think it's important to look for ways that yearning, even if we can't move home, can just sculpt the way we live in the places we're in now. I talk at the end of my book about how nostalgia oftentimes can be a really hard emotion to deal with, because there's often some grief in it, depending on how much we miss people who've also passed away in the places we've left behind. But in nostalgia, I think we can tap into some good questions about what inspires us about the places where we used to live. How do they continue to inspire the way we live if it's a different place? How can the gifts and the lessons we learned in our home communities serve the places we live in now? And so I think it's a beautiful thing, actually, to be able to bring those lessons with you to wherever you currently live.
Thanks a lot for that call. Patrick joins us next in Madison. Patrick, hello.
Hello. Yes, this is Patrick, and I'm really excited to be listening to this guest of yours. I am an immigrant from West Africa, and some friends of mine and myself have joined together to create a farm here where we can grow indigenous crops, food crops that fellow immigrants can relate to, you know. And so when your guests talk about going back to Idaho to join the agricultural community, I can relate to that very much, because that's exactly what we are planning to do. I just want some words of encouragement from your guest, and let me know how I can get her book.
Patrick, thanks for the call. The title again is Uprooted, and to Patrick and his friends, but literally and figuratively putting down new West African roots here in Wisconsin, Grace.
Oh, such wonderful work, and thank you, Patrick, for doing it. I think if we're going to see farms flourish in the days and years to come, it's going to be people like you who are putting down roots and who are teaching the rest of us as well how to grow food in better and more sustainable ways.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Keith in Black River Falls. Keith, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to add to the conversation. I'm somebody that's made that return journey. I grew up on a dairy farm and in a small community of 3,000 plus, moved off to college, lived many different places, even overseas, eventually ended up in the Madison area where I met my wife, who was from Chicago. And we would occasionally come back to my hometown for different holidays and visit with relatives. And it was actually she and our tomboy daughter who fell in love with the farm community that I came from. And that compelled us to kind of shake off the hustle and bustle of the Madison area and move back. And while we're not hugely engaged in the agricultural community personally, we were very much connected with that again. And my wife, as I said, grew up in Chicago, but she found a sense of community that she'd never had in any of the places that she lived. And I joke with her that she should have been born 100 years ago to a frontier farmer cooking for 10 or 15 people. She just loves it in this community.
Keith, I got to ask, had you thought of moving back there, or did this all come from your wife and daughter?
I always had, you know, fond thoughts of my hometown, but I never actively thought of moving back.
Huh.
So it was the impetus from her that caused it to happen. And I'm so glad it happened. So many things that I really didn't recognize as a youth that I appreciate so much more as an adult, I've come to discover here, rediscover here, I should say.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Keith. And that reminds me, Grace, you've written, since your book came out, actually, you wrote a piece over this year of COVID. It seems like some people are doing what Keith ended up doing. And I don't know about his time frame there, but people are now maybe looking more at going back to that smaller town, hometown. What are we seeing out there?
It's really interesting looking at the data. About 52% of adults aged about 18 to 29 moved back in or were living with their parents in 2020. That's the largest share since the Great Depression, according to the Pew Research Center. And in addition, if you look at rural migration data for counties of about 250,000 people or less from 2016, 17, and 18, you also saw a pretty sizable in-migration of people, enough to match or surpass out-migration most of the time. And so there were a lot of people moving into these small rural communities. And I think that it's really interesting to see how many of those are what Wes Jackson of the Land Institute has called homecomers, people who saw themselves as returning to a community that they had roots in and that they wanted to be a part of going forward.
Thanks a lot for that call. Grace, in our last couple minutes or so, what is your advice for that person who is in that small community and loves it and wants to put it on people's radar in a positive way? How can they help root themselves and others?
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, wherever you are, I love the quote. It's from a guy named Jim Elliott. Wherever you are, be all there. I've loved getting involved in my community here in Virginia. I'm on the tree board. I love being able to participate in town council meetings and to ministries. And I think that that's the sort of work that's going to continue to strengthen whatever community you're in. But in addition to that, I think it's very important that we continue to emphasize the fact that our places, even if they're struggling, have a lot of inherent beauty and value, and that we should love them for what they are and try to make them stronger. Supporting small businesses, of course, is a very vital thing in this time of COVID, as many local businesses and business owners have struggled. And I'm hopeful that we can kind of resurrect some of that love of the local and of those places as people are moving back to rural America, and hopefully see some neat entrepreneurial opportunities open up as a result.
We'll leave it there. Grace, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to all the people who called in as well.
That was journalist Grace Olmsted. She joined us in March to talk about her book, Uprooted, Recovering the Legacy of the Places That We Have Left Behind. You're listening to Central Time. Now, if you are anything like me, you've probably been late returning a library book or two in your life. But really, if you're more like me, it's been way more than just a couple. But a library in England just had a book sent back to them after being due around 63 years ago. Newcastle Libraries shared a photo online showing the copy of Daryl Huff's 1954 book, How to Lie with Statistics, along with an anonymous note saying, "Better late than never. Apologies for the late return." As mentioned, the person who returned the book stayed anonymous, and the library system is looking for the mystery patron, not to get them in trouble, but to give them some free books. So if you're that person and you happen to be listening to this in Wisconsin or online, Newcastle Libraries wants to hear from you. Now, this is not the first time news has been made by a person returning a library book around six decades late. This spring, we talked to Betty Diamond, who also returned a library book around 63 years late. So if you missed that conversation between Rob and Betty, I highly recommend you check it out at WPR.org. And as they say, it's better late than never. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.